Chris has had a long career at EPA. He started at EPA in 1980, and he's had a number of senior leadership positions within the agency. At one point, he won the award for the gold medal for meritorious service, which is awarded to people within government, within EPA specifically, I guess, that have done outstanding work. And it is no surprise to me whatsoever that this man would have won that award, because he is a credit to the agency. In fact, I think he's a credit to anybody who is called a bureaucrat, which is sometimes often derided. He is a credit to government service. In December, when EPA held a hearing on the RVO, he sat through more than 12 hours of testimony. And I walked up to him at one point and said, "Chris, you're really having to go the extra mile, and I commend you for sitting through all of this." And he said, "Oh, no. These people have come here. They feel strongly about this. They pay my salary. I want to hear what they have to say." And I tell you what, that was refreshing to hear. Chris Grundler is a guy who really does care. He really is trying to do the right thing. He's trying to give his superiors the right information. And while we might not disagree with where they were on the proposed rule, I can assure you that he is looking through the comments that EPA has received carefully, and will be providing his leadership at the agency with the best information. So, Chris, if you would join me on stage and maybe give your up-to-the-minute thoughts on the RFS and other things going on at EPA, but please join me in welcoming a real credit to government service, Chris Grundler.
My apologies to Mr. Lickus. I just stole your water. This is my imitation of Senator Rubio. Thank you for that quite generous introduction, Bob. I have read all of RFA's comments, all 52 pages, not all the attachments yet, Jeff. And as I told Bob, I decided not to do a word search for fatally flawed throughout those pages, but they were very, very thoughtful. First, let me apologize for screwing up your agenda. I know you like to run a tight ship, Bob, so do I. I really wanted to be here yesterday, particularly to mix it up on your lunch panel. That looked like a lot of fun. But I'm glad I made it here, and I'm grateful for the invitation and for rearranging your schedule so I could tell you what's on my mind. And lots on my mind. But before I do that, I wanted to begin a little bit by telling you a little bit more about where I come from. Because I think where people come from often tells you how they approach life, how they approach decisions, how they look at problems. And I grew up in the state of Michigan. I still live in the state of Michigan. I spend a lot of time in Washington, but I live in Michigan. My home's in Michigan. My family's in Michigan. My roots are in Michigan. And when I was growing up in the southern part of the state, southwestern Michigan, I spent a lot of time exploring the landscapes, the farms, the forests, particularly the coastal landscapes. And they had a very profound impact on me and the choices I made later on growing up. And I think in Michigan, people who grew up around the Great Lakes will tell you that we feel a very strong connection to the landscapes of that part of our country. It's what Wallace Stegner refers to a sense of place. We have a strong sense of place, a connectedness to the land and to one another and to what it brings, the way of life in Michigan. And not every place has that, but you know, that's certainly how I feel about it and how a lot of people in the state feel, and I tried to instill that same kind of feeling with my family. And as soon as my sons were old enough to drive a tractor, you know, they got a chance to, and it wasn't voluntary, but they learned something from it, to help our neighbor bring in the harvest for a couple summers. And it was hard work, and they started at dawn, and they finished at dark. But they gained a respect for the land by doing that work. They gained a respect for the people who work the land, and I think that's very, very valuable. And what they took from that experience and what I took from my experience growing up there, has led me to devote my life to protecting the land, protecting the environment, to public service. And that's very, very important to me, and it's really how I approach these things. And I know that these are values shared by many of the people in this business. And so I think this is something that we share. The other thing I like to think, having kind of grown up in that environment and coming from the Midwest, we like to think that we have a certain kind of common sense and practicality. You'll have to judge that from yourself by what EPA does. And every time I use the word common sense in the same sentence as the RFS, my team starts laughing at me. But I really do think it's possible, and that's the only way I know how to approach these things. And, of course, growing up in the Midwest, we're pretty open people. And so that's another thing that sometimes is surprising to people in Washington, because I say exactly what's on my mind. That has gotten me into some hot water occasionally in my first year on this job. But, again, that's the only way I know how to be, and I'm not going to change. I can't change. So I've been in this job for about 17 months, and it's been a very interesting 17 months. And I do some things other than the RFS occasionally. I thought it'd be important for you to understand that my organization does a range of environmental business in the world of transportation. Essentially, what we worry about is everything that moves and makes pollution is something that we try to address. We try to reconcile the transportation sector with the environment. And so I lead an organization that is known for removing lead from gasoline many years ago. More recently, sulfur from gasoline, sulfur from diesel fuel. We establish emission standards for everything that moves. We test those things. We certify every engine and vehicle that's sold in America before it can be sold. We deal with large sources like marine engines, offshore vessels, aviation, locomotives. And more recently, we've been very busy addressing carbon pollution, greenhouse gas emissions. We've done, over the last few years, three different sets of greenhouse gas standards for two rounds of standards on passenger cars, one round on heavy-duty trucks. And yesterday, the President announced that we're taking another step with respect to medium and heavy-duty trucks and setting the next generation of fuel economy and fuel efficiency standards. We've doubled the mileage of vehicles out to 2025 from passenger cars. And we did it in a collaborative way. With the industry, with labor, with the environmental community, and at the end, everyone was standing up and saying, this is good work, and this is going to be good for our economy, and good for the environment, and good for the planet. But enough background. I had two main reasons why I wanted to come to Orlando, and was very eager to come when Bob invited me last December. The main reason, of course, is to listen to Bob Dineen's State of the Industry speech. And I'm very sorry that I missed that yesterday. I hope it'll be on YouTube soon. I've heard about these remarks over the years, and I really wanted to hear them. But the second reason is that I really wanted to provide you with some context and what our thinking was behind our 2014 RVO proposal. And it is a proposal. Because much has been written about it, and much has been really lost in the reporting and in the commentary on our proposal, and you deserve to understand what really went into our thinking behind that. And I also want to quickly give you an update on the process, on where we stand. So like I said, about 17 months ago, October 2012, as my predecessor was walking out the door, she left me with a little bit of unfinished business. And she said, good luck with this. The first was mopping up after a handful of very creative crooks who were generating faulty RINs, essentially a pretty elaborate counterfeiting scheme. Those people now are in jail or on their way to jail. The second was a little piece of business addressing petitions from 10 or 12 different organizations saying that we should waive the RFS due to disastrous drought, a drought that we haven't seen in this country for many, many years. And that was my introduction to the wonderful world of RFS. And then in January, things got even more interesting in the RFS world. The RIN market became quite active, if you recall. There were many, many calls for the repeal of the law itself. Those calls continue, as you well know. I had the distinct honor and pleasure of appearing before not one, but three different committees of Congress, which were not very friendly for most of the time I was in front of them. We did put out a RIN fraud proposal to address the validity of RIN so people had more confidence in the marketplace. We put out a 2013 proposal for the RVO. We put out a final RVO proposal. We put out a 2014 proposal, as you know. And I won't even mention the fact that during this time, as a manager, I had to deal with mandatory government furloughs and mandatory government shortfalls, new petitions of pathways coming in every month, the backlog increasing, and a whole variety of lawsuits. So it's been a very, very active year, and I'm not complaining about it. It's not boring at all. But for sure, it is a challenging, here's my Rubio profession again, it's a very, very challenging part of our business. But to me, again, my responsibilities and the responsibilities of my team are very clear. The way I approach every one of these decisions over this year and going forward, I ask my team three very basic questions. What does the law say? What does the science and data tell us? And what's the right thing to do? What's the practical thing to do? What makes sense in this situation? And that's how we're going to do our business. That's how we're going to continue to do our business. And we're going to be doing it in an open, transparent way. We have to. We have to play these issues right down the middle. And I'm not going to tell one group one thing and another group another thing. That's not the way we're going to do business, and we're not going to do business in a vacuum. And sometimes, as Bob knows, I'll tell different groups things that they don't want to hear. And we'll have an argument about it, and we'll talk about it. At the end of the day, and what my experience has been over 33-plus years at EPA, if you can get the facts on the table and people of goodwill around those facts, you can solve problems. And our history in this organization is replete with success, and my hope is we'll do the same thing here. So given this context, one of the most disappointing things, probably the most disappointing things that I have heard in response to the 2014 proposal, amidst all the shouts and murmurs, is that EPA no longer supports the development and use of biofuels. And I'm here to tell you that that's wrong. That is absolutely wrong. We know because my team has done the modeling. We know that if we're going to achieve what science is telling us we must achieve in terms of greenhouse gas reductions by the middle of this century, if we want to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, biofuels has got to be a part of that solution set. We're not going to be able to come up with the kind of reductions, 80% reductions, simply by establishing efficiency standards. We will, and we will continue to do so, and that will be a major chunk. We have to make the transportation system as a whole more efficient. And we have to reduce the carbon intensity of our transportation fuels. There's not a doubt. If we're going to achieve what science tells us we need to achieve to avoid the worst impacts, I'll say it again, biofuels has got to be part of that solution set. In my opinion, it's way, way too early to declare failure here. So our overriding goal with this 2014 RVO proposal is to put the RFS on what we call a manageable trajectory, while continuing to support the growth of renewable fuels in our transportation supply. But as you're probably painfully aware, you know, I think we have to address some of the practical realities that we see today in the marketplace. I can't afford to get into an argument about why this reality exists and who's to blame. And how did we get here? The fact is, it exists, and we couldn't ignore it. And so we have, for the first time, exercised our authority to adjust these standards. But again, I want to emphasize that this is a proposal. A second goal, in addition to trying to put the RFS on a manageable trajectory so we can manage this program in a sensible way, is that we sought public input on a durable policy going forward so we can provide the market with some sense of certainty and predictability about how we would set these standards in the future. Now, again, what has been lost in the discussion is that the way we're proposing this durable policy work is that each year, built into the standards for the subsequent year, would be the growth in capacity of the market to continue to use more higher level of ethanol blends. Unfortunately, no, that has been lost with all the focus on the numbers, and I get people, and particularly reporters, want to focus on the numbers. But these are two very, very important policy points that we sought input on, and we are getting input on them. But again, these in the reporting and in the discussion, okay, these what I think are central points for the policy going forward, which is how do we put this on a manageable trajectory? What is that trajectory look like? What is it reasonable for us to assume is that growth pattern? And how can we be more predictable about this so that we don't go through this argument year after year? Also lost is the fact that the agency laid out three different approaches to how to set the standards, each of which has very different implications for different aspects of the business. Also lost is the fact that we put in a pretty wide range of numbers for each standard, asking for the latest information and analysis. And also lost in the reporting is the fact that EPA time and time again throughout the proposal asked for updated information, asked for comment about our reasoning and how we approach this thing. So where are we on the process? I can report to you that the notice and comment process is working very, very well. Thank you very much. The public hearing that we had that Bob referenced was a record for our office, both in terms of attendees and in terms of the number of testifiers. And I have to tell you that what we heard and what my team heard, and we did stay to the end because that's our job and it's a very important part of our job, we heard a lot of moving stories, kind of personal narratives on both sides of this issue. And I really respect people taking their time and coming to this hearing, particularly the people that aren't paid to be there. No offense. You know, citizens coming and telling me about, you know, how many generations they've been farming and how this policy has changed their community. Equally moving were people whose job it is and whose life pursuit it is to deal with food issues and hunger issues and their perspective on this. And it's very, very important, and I really respect people who take the time. And this young man coming all the way from Lansing, Michigan to present his testimony and driving his flex fuel vehicle, that took some courage. That's not an easy thing to do for a young man to do it, and I'm sorry he decided to sleep in. I couldn't thank him again. I was relieved to learn that he said he was from Lansing, and I asked him if he went to Michigan State University, he said no, and so that made me listen more carefully to his comments. and the public has certainly responded in terms of their written comments. We have received now, last count, over 100,000 written comments, over 6,000 unique comments, and hundreds of what my team calls substantive comments. And I asked them, what is a substantive comment? And they said a substantive comment they're defining as comments that ran more than 100 pages in length, which, by the way, is longer than the actual proposal that we put out. And so that's pretty impressive. And I also want to pause at this moment. I don't know if Bob Greco from the American Petroleum Institute is still here, but I really want to thank him for interrupting my wife and my dinner one evening during the public comment period where I picked up the phone and I heard a recording from someplace in Virginia urging me to comment to EPA on our RFS proposal. I'm not making this up. And I really think I'm being targeted because I've also gotten calls, numerous calls, urging me to write to the President of the United States and telling him to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. So I don't see Bob out there, but he must have an early tea time. So we're reading all the comments now. It will take some time because, again, this is very important. We take this process seriously, and it will take time. We said in the proposal that our goal was to finalize a 2014 RVO by spring, And my definition of spring is midnight, January 20th. And that's going to be a very, very heavy lift. So let me just close, because I know that Bob likes to run a tight ship. He's told me that three times. What else is on our RFS plate for 2014? It's going to be another very exciting year. Believe it or not, I want to put out a 2015 NPRM before 2015. We have to get back on some sense of normal scheduling schedule on these rules, on these standards, for all the reasons that you understand. So we're eager to begin working on 2015 right away, probably as we finalize 2014. We have petitions for reconsideration of the 2013 standard. We will be reproposing the 2013 cellulosic standard for sure. We're facing litigation as well as petitions over the 2013 standard. We're in court now. We'll be finalizing our proposal that to address the this fraud in the RIN market. We'll be finalizing another set of new pathways, what we call Pathways 2 final rule. We'll be proposing a Pathways 3 proposing another set of renewable fuel pathways and feedstocks known as Pathways 3 this year. And we're going to be working on ways to, and appreciating and RFA's comments on this, and I agree, we have to find ways to streamline this process. I mean, people cannot be in this business if it takes us, you know, 2 years to make decisions on these new pathways and these new feedstocks. And I'm disappointed that we have this backlog, and we have to find a different way to do this. And so you're going to be hearing more from us very soon about how we're going to go about trying to streamline this process and give the industry some more information on how to navigate this in a way that will lead to more expeditious decisions by the government. That's very important. So let me just close by saying once again how much I value the relationship we've had with the RFA over the years. I consider Mr. Dineen a gentleman. He is always forthright. He has never lied to us. I was going to say he's never agreed with us, but that's not true. He does agree with us occasionally. He's a very good advocate for you, and he does it in a very, very professional way, which is not always the case with people in this space, and I honor that. I also want to thank you and Jeff Cooper here for the very thoughtful and thorough comments that you've submitted under this proposal and the new information. I can tell you for sure that we're going to be making our final determination here using the most up-to-date information that we can find. And we're gathering that both through the comments as well as through our work with other parts of the administration, specifically the Ag Department and DOE. And I just think it's very, very important to keep this, even though it has become so heated, you know, we just have to keep talking with one another. You know, my door, and Bob knows this, is always open. I've had a chance to meet with many of the companies in this room, and we just have to keep talking. And I will continue to be very direct and honest and tell you the same thing that I'm telling everybody else, and we'll find a way forward, because it's very, very important to me that we get the RFS on this, what we call a manageable trajectory, and we have to work together on what does that mean. And at the end of the day, you know, what's going to carry the arguments will be the best reasoning, the best analysis, the best information, and hopefully you'll all understand what that is when we get done. So thanks again for listening. Thanks, all of you who stuck around for this second day to hear what I had to say. And I hope you invite me back. Thank you.
You have time for a couple of questions, right?
Sure.
Chris, thank you very much. I think now you have an understanding of why I think so highly of this man and why he's such a credit to his agency. We're going to take a couple of questions. So if people want to line up, not a whole lot, but while people are coming to the mics, I'm going to offer two to get you started. One, I hope, is a softball question. The other is maybe a little bit more high and tight. I'm not going to tell you which is which. But you've said quite passionately that you want to do the right thing here and that you believe that biofuels have a role in the future. So I guess the first question would be, what is EPA's plan for biofuels if the RINs are not allowed to do the job that they're supposed to do, if they're not allowed to drive the economic investment necessary to move the market? And then the second question would be, is there a difference between ethanol supply and ethanol consumption?
Well, as Bob Wells knows well, because I think roughly 25% of the RFA comments were, I'm sure, not written by Jeff, but written by a high-priced attorney. The EPA is interpreting supply as supply to the consumer, because we think the purpose of the RFS is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and those emissions get reduced when they're used, not if they're sitting in a tank someplace. And I'm sure we'll have some more conversations about that. I'm not the lawyer. I went to engineering school. But that, to me, seems like common sense. On the second question, you know, what is our plan if the RIN market fails? And I'm guessing that's the high and tight one. I'm not sure
the other one was.
Okay. Well, I guess the way I look at this is really failure is not an option. And there's been a lot of confusion about what the purpose of the RIN market is. And from our perspective, and I like to remind people, one, we got very specific direction from the Congress to provide this compliance mechanism. And that mechanism was designed, again, in an open way with the help of the industry in designing it. It's meant to be a compliance mechanism. How then that market functions and what the pricing is are a function of the market dynamics and the price of corn and the price of oil and the relative price of complying. So as in the agency is on record, and this is what I told all three committees, it wasn't terribly surprising, and independent economists and others predicted that as the market approached what I like to call the saturation point, I don't like to use the word blend wall, but the saturation level of 10% ethanol, it was completely predictable that those RIN prices would go higher, and that's how the market works. And so I don't think, although there are a lot of people who were expressing surprise, we weren't surprised, and we said we weren't surprised. Now, it may have happened a little bit sooner than some people expected. I think we were surprised that we saw those prices going up in January. But this is how the market was predicted to work. Now, I don't have an opinion, and I'm going to try very, very hard, as I told one committee, to avoid predicting RIN prices, just like we don't want to get in the business of predicting the price of gasoline. Again, that's going to be a function of the markets. And there's been a lot of, again, rhetoric about what's the relationship between RIN prices and retail prices and what's happening at the wholesale pricing level, and it's a pretty complicated situation. What I care about is compliance. And ensuring compliance with the RFS, and I don't think anybody wants EPA interfering in these marketplace dynamics and getting involved in corn pricing and gasoline pricing and so on. So what's our plan if the market doesn't work? I don't know. I don't have a plan for if the market doesn't work. Again, our plan is to try to use all the tools we can to implement this law. I mean, that's my job as your humble servant, is to try to make the best of what Congress has given the agency and to use the discretion in a sensible way to further the objectives of this law, which are very, very important objectives. And they're not just environmental objectives, we like to point out, but they're also energy security objectives and rural economic objectives that all went into the reasoning behind this law. You know, it wasn't my job to write it. Congress actually didn't even consult with EPA in writing it. But it's not my job to rewrite the law or to read things into the law that aren't there. It's our job to implement it the best way we can. And I'm sorry if I'm sounding like a broken record, but what we're really trying to do here is put the RFS on a manageable trajectory so that we're just not fighting about it every year. And because that's not good for anybody. It's not good for business. You know, it's not good for the environment. Business people, I'm guessing most of you are all business people, you guys hate uncertainty. So that's why I keep, when I sit down with folks, I keep trying to point out, you know, what is this manageable trajectory? What's a reasonable path forward? What's reasonable for us to assume in terms of future consumption and capacity of the system to absorb more and more ethanol? And then that will get factored into the subsequent year standard, and that's how we can find a steady path forward. That's what we're trying to do.
I know there are several people lined up, but maybe just because of time constraints, and I apologize. Jerry, if you want to ask your question, and then we'll probably have to let Mr. Grundler go.
Thanks,
and,
Bob.
And Chris, I should warn you, this is a gentleman from the Fourth Estate, so you're on record now.
That's Jerry, okay, as long as I tell the truth.
Jerry Perkins from Biofuels Journal magazine. First of all, let me say editorially that I find it laudable for you to come here today and explain a decision that has roiled this industry for months. Let me give you an opportunity to respond to a charge that I've heard made from some people in the ethanol industry that the EPA's decision to roll back the RVO was predicated on the White House's fears that higher RIN prices would lead to higher gasoline prices and be suicide at the election polls for this administration. Please respond to this.
No, that's not true. Look, I want to own this proposal. I do own this proposal. This was EPA's proposal. This was EPA's decision. And as I said, we were addressing what we consider practical realities in the marketplace. And when we looked at the number in the law and what was consumed based on the information we had at the time, we saw no way to get from A to B, and that we needed to exercise the discretion that as we see it, Congress gave us. For every regulatory proposal, there's an interagency process. You know, in this case, it was a very vigorous process, as it should be, because this policy intersects government policy that is much bigger than EPA. You know, and it impacts trade policy, it impacts economic policy, it impacts agricultural policy, and those are all important considerations. This is EPA's proposal. And the final will be EPA's final, and it will be based on the most up-to-date information and all the comments that we're listening very carefully to. But it's a good question.
Chris, thank you again. I appreciate it very much. Join me in thanking Chris Grundler.
Thank you, Mr. Rickard. Thank you.